Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 441. Tuesday, December 28th, 2022. Hey, everybody. Very sorry about the dearth of podcasts. What I have for you here is a recording that I made with John Atwood. This was 9 days ago. And I'm able to get it to you today because, well, for once, during the day, a work day, in fact, I have my living space to myself. There's nobody else here, so I can record. What I'm going to do right now is listen to this conversation with John, which I have not revisited since it was recorded, make a few notes, and then come back at the end with any observations that I picked up. But in the meantime, here's my conversation with John Atwood. He was the guest on the most recent episode. We were talking about communication technology, and we continue on that theme. Well, I'm back here with John Atwood, who is very kindly joined me again in the Lexus. Is this Lexus? Yeah, Lexus Studio.
Yeah, it's the hybrid Lexus.
Yeah.
I was impressed. The sound quality came out better than I thought from our last interview.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a big, expensive field recorder that I used for these types of interviews, and now very cheap consumer electronics do as good a job. Not better, but as good.
Yep.
But last time we talked about the history of communication technology and largely broadcast technology, you know, many-to-one technology, or no, one-to-many.
One-to-many, yeah.
And we talked about radio. We spent most of our time on radio, I think.
Yeah, a little bit on TV.
TV, and then the switch from broadcast TV to cable TV. Let's pick up with social media.
Okay.
What are your thoughts?
Well, part of the technology transition was going to, was basically based on the internet, which even before social media became a thing, was a pretty radical thing because it enabled everybody to see almost everything if they wanted to look. And we talked about push and pull media. At least in the old days, the internet was pretty much a pull media. You had to go to a website. But what happened is that these people got these ideas of, if they could get you running an app and get you engaged, the whole point, the whole word is engagement, then they can start popping up ads. And if they know more about you, they can tailor the ads and then get the advertisers to pay more money because they're more supposedly more effective. And that's happened in, different companies have done it different ways. The classic case is Facebook, which, was basically the way to sort of connect everybody to everything. That was Zuckerberg's original idea. But it's sort of really morphed into this kind of information scooping technology. I remember one of my friends had gotten Facebook on his iPhone, and after watching him use it, I just said, wow, what an incredible waste of time. And that's why he never got onto Facebook. But it sucks you in. But then they started adding things like the news feed. And that the trouble with that is that that tends to amplify your own biases, because if they see that you're interested in something on the right or something on the left, they'll just keep amplifying it. And that also happens like with YouTube, Google's YouTube. They have suggestions. It's not quite as, in your face, but, and these are good examples of push media. One of the things I wanted to talk about, though, and this kind of goes back to my background as an electrical engineer, you study things like system stability and, feedback systems and things like that. And it's really easy to get systems that will go out of control, to oscillate or latch up or do something that you don't want them to do. And, I think what's happened with the social media is that the ability for people, first of all, to propagate ideas to other people and then have it be sort of amplified by the social media companies it's an example of something that has way too much gain. In other words, one person with like maybe an anti-vax idea can spread that to the whole country, whereas in the old days, if someone was a crackpot, there's first of all, there's always been crackpots. since day one. I mean, you could, it's, you know, that's part of the human condition. And, but there was always a lot of friction, you know, back before the internet, or, you know, before, modern media, you know, you could have a newsletter, but you'd have to type it up and then get it, you know, lithographed or reproduced. And then you have postage. And so there's friction. And so ideas can spread around, but the friction keeps it from just spiraling out of control. The trouble with the internet is that it's so easy to communicate now that friction is gone. And the result is that you just sort of see this incredible division of, you know, people just from political ideas or ideological ideas, and then even crazy stuff, you know, QAnon and things like that. I mean, that, you know, there were always people who believed in conspiracies, but the fact that just, you know, has, you know, 20 or 30% of the population believing it is incredible, you know. So
yeah,
what, you know, we talked last time about, you know, how do we solve these problems? And one of them is to put more friction into the system, to make it a little harder. Like, a good example of this is email. By making sending an email message essentially free, that's what allowed the whole spam thing to go completely out of control. And if you just charged a little bit, like, you know, 1 cent of an email message to a particular user, that would slow that whole thing way down. And yet for people who use it, you know, like commercially, you know, big companies have no problems having a mail campaign where they'll pay the post office mail to send you junk mail.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine if the mail was free. Can you imagine how much junk mail you would get?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon as far as the email goes, but that's a good example of, you know, ease of communication can almost cause trouble.
Yeah, that 1 cent per email, or even a tenth of a cent per email.
Exactly.
Is akin to the, you know, tenth of a cent tax on electronic trades.
Right. Right.
You know, that would certainly slow things down.
Yep. Yep. I think, I'm very much in favor of that for the trades because, you know, I don't know if you've read anything about the high frequency traders and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. I mean, it's really out of control.
It is. Yeah. And it can cause, as you say, wild gyrations and destabilizing, just sort of runaway effects. And no human being can follow what's happening in real time.
No, it's in the milliseconds or nanoseconds, you know, that these computer algorithms are doing their thing. So, but getting back to the social media thing, we need some way to just slow things down a little bit. You know?
Yeah. So we were talking about different viewpoints over lunch. Mm-hmm. We talked about long-termism, which is the idea that, you know, you should be thinking about how your actions today are going to affect the human experiment or project or civilization thousands of years from now, which I think is silly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is effective altruism, which used to be, it used to be a methodology and a sort of philosophy or a paradigm of just using critical thinking and data to determine, you know, where best to put your charitable dollars. And it has since morphed into something weird, but it's also been picked up as a bugaboo on the left and, you know, utterly distorted in the left's presentation of what it means.
Yeah. It is really true that there's a lot of bad altruism out there. In other words, nonprofits that where 90% of the money goes to the, you know, administration overhead, things like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, there actually are, I've seen sites that rank different nonprofit, you know, agencies, you know, like United Way and things like that. And, you know, some are good and some are really bad. You know, apparently, I guess the one that I've heard about more recently was, you remember Susan Komen, the one, breast cancer awareness thing,
Race for the Cure.
Yeah, with the pink little ribbon thing.
Right.
Apparently, that one is percentage going to a real cause is pretty small.
Right.
And you know, I won't even get into it. That's a whole mess right there. Let's see what else. Well, of course, the thing with the effect of altruism is coming up now is with the SBF. You know, Sam Bankman-Fried, because apparently his mom was really into that. And he was doing a lot of donations. In fact, there's a bunch of organizations that are kind of screwed right now because, you know, he had promised them a, you know, big, you know, $1 million donations, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So
Sam Bankman-Fried, who is the founder of Alameda Research and also the FTX exchange, which are, you know, intertwined.
Yes.
He did something that I thought was really smart, but also, you know, it was criminal. He's been making tens of millions of dollars of political donations and giving to both Republicans and Democrats, although he would give to Democrats openly, which is why he was a darling of the media and why the corporate media was not interested in crucifying him when, you know, his crimes became clear. Then he would give to Republicans through proxies.
Right.
So, and he was giving roughly equally. He's just buying access.
Yeah.
And he was buying access so that he would have the influence needed to put regulation of cryptocurrencies and other crypto products under, what was it, the FCC.
Not the SEC. It's CBC or something.
A smaller regulatory body that has less power, less prestige in Congress, and, you know, just a smaller budget.
Right.
Basically, he wanted weak regulation of his industry.
Right.
And he was making donations to both parties. The thing that I thought was really smart, though, and this is what I absolutely agree with, he was never funding candidates in general elections. He's only funding them in primary elections. And I think that primary elections, I mean, one, if you care, and you're not just, you know, virtue signaling or tweaking your own neurology with your political participation, you have to participate in the primaries, and most people don't.
Right, because that's where the choices are decided.
Right. That's where you have an actual choice.
Right.
By the time the primary is over, you have two anodyne corporate-friendly candidates.
Exactly.
And, you know, your choice is neoliberalism with a blue tint, neoliberalism with a red tint. What do you prefer?
Right.
If you don't participate in the primary, you really just haven't participated in any meaningful way. And so I absolutely agree with his philosophy of focusing all his donations there. It's just that he was basically using customer funds.
Yes.
He
was doing all sorts of things, like,
yeah,
you know, buying his parents a, you know, $30 million house in Bahamas. And it was as the guy who came in, I forget the guy's name, the guy who took over as CEO when they kicked SBF out, he was the guy who wound up Enron.
Oh.
And he's also done other things like this. He says it's the worst situation he's ever seen as far as, you know, just poor documentation, crazy, you know. He said for example, Alameda and FTX were essentially the same thing.
Right.
Even though SBF was claiming, oh, I just don't know much about Alameda, you know, crazy stuff like that. So, actually, there was a good posting in the Naked Capitalism site a few days ago where there was a guy who actually traced the political donations, and it was very targeted on the senators and congressmen who were deciding the crypto regulation.
How it would be regulated.
Right. Know. And there are a handful of these sort of crypto politicians who are, you know, basically they're trying to really push it hard right now.
There are some.
So anyway, so let's say we were talking about
social media.
Yeah. I'm not really the best person to talk about it because I don't, the only social media I participate in is Reddit. I participate that purely as a reader, not as a content generator. I do find it quite interesting to look at a lot of different Reddit threads and stuff.
Whatever Google search you do,
yeah,
if you just put the word Reddit at the end of your search,
yeah,
the relevance and the quality of your search results is magnified.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't tried that yet. My default search engine is DuckDuckGo, but I think that uses the Bing or the Microsoft one, or maybe it's Google. I don't know. They basically sort of contract out the search engine.
I think they. I spoke to the CEO of DuckDuckGo many years ago, and so maybe they're doing things differently now. But at the time, you would do a search in DuckDuckGo, and it would go and do multiple searches on other platforms, and then aggregate them for you, sort them and aggregate them. But you know, the appeal was they weren't keeping any data about you or your searches.
Right. And whereas, you know, Google, they're pretty much keeping everything they can, as far as I can tell.
That is their business model.
Yep. So, anyway, actually, let me transition over to the thing about how do ideas from smart people get around?
All right.
And this is something that I've just, worked this out on my own. When you look at the society in general, there's always a handful of people who are either smart or lucky, or both, who discover something new, either through their own hard work or through an insight or, whatever.
Or they recognize the value in something that somebody else has done.
Right. And then they, how does that idea get spread around? Now, if we go way back, let's go back to hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. You had, small bands and, they might see something that maybe, hey, the guys on the next hill over, they have this new thing that chops the meat up better than the rocks that we have. And so, yeah, they found a new way of chipping the flint to make a knife or something like that. Then later on, let's say we go into the era of, empires and stuff, like the Persian Empire, Roman Empire, things like that. There you have a central authority that can spread ideas. If somebody has a new way of making bronze or something, that gets spread around, and because of the communication of the empire, that gets spread out. It's interesting because you can see, even on really diverse and distant cultures, the fact that, like, for example, that, in China, they developed the, the gunpowder, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that eventually worked its way back to Europe, even though the links between China and Europe were pretty tenuous.
Right.
But they were enough to get it through there. Now, what's interesting is that the printing press was originated in China way before Gutenberg. And that's an idea that had to be invented independently in Europe.
Now, did the Chinese printing press have movable type?
I think it did. It had, but of course they were per Chinese character. Mm-hmm. Okay. And given that they have so many different characters, that actually it's a good motivation to have a printing press as opposed to doing it by hand. So in following what we talked about last time about the advent of technology in Europe, you get the printing press. Well, then you start to, you have writing. Well, actually writing, even in the classical era, writing was all by hand, but you could save someone's smart idea from the past and pass it on to the future. And then with the printing press, and then with the advent of cheaper paper, and then in the 19th century, what they called steam presses, which were basically steam engine run mm-hmm. presses, you could have, vast amount of printing, very cheap. And again, the ideas spread very quickly. But there's still some friction in the process. You have to submit a paper. They have to agree to print it. Also, you have to basically be in a situation where if you're smart and have a good idea, that it can be used. Look, what if, Mozart was just a farm kid in Austria, or, Einstein was in a chattel in Poland or something like that with no other training, those minds would have been gone to waste, so to speak. And it's always amazing to think of how many Einsteins there are out there that just never got developed or never, used their talents. The reason we were talking about this is when you get up to the internet, again, the ease of transmission becomes so much easier now. The problem is it's almost overwhelming. How do you decide who's got a new idea or an important idea and who doesn't? And we're sort of drowning in a sea of information now. And the trouble is there's some good and some bad, and it's not as easy to tell.
Well, from my perspective, the trouble is that there's so much information, you can't possibly sample more than an infinitesimal fraction of it.
Right.
So you're dependent on curation algorithms.
Absolutely.
And the curation algorithms, they're written by people whose interests roughly coincide with yours in some places, but in other places they are diametrically opposed.
Right. And they might have an agenda, or they might have a lacuna, an admission, they things they don't even think about.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's why it's important to have to, be careful about how you get your information. I when I browse the web, I do to a bunch of aggregator sites, things like Naked Capitalism, Hacker News is a good one. And what they, these are people who put up links to what they think is interesting. Now the problem is that in like with Hacker News, it's a pretty, it's tech oriented, of course, but it's, it's, you know, it doesn't have much of a political agenda. Now, if you, let's say, get a digital subscription to, let's say, the Washington Post, you're going to get their curated ideas, which are not...
Jeff Bezos is curated ideas.
He's a little hands off, but they're not going to go against him, that's for sure.
Right.
And, you know, you posted the thing a week or two ago about the institutions that, you know, well, how the mainstream media has changed from just reporting news to having sort of agendas or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Rephrase that. I'm not really.
I'm not sure which post you're referencing. I mean, the mainstream media certainly has a social and a political agenda.
Well, I think they call it a narrative. They have, you know, instead of just posting news items, they're forwarding a certain narrative.
Right.
So, and now one thing you can do is, I remember I've been a subscriber to The Economist magazine for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Wally Chan had, you know, he had gotten it for a long time, but he said, you know, when I was telling him I'm subscribing to The Economist, he says, well, be careful, use an Economist filter when you're reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Because The Economist is, they have a, you know, they strongly believe in the neoliberal globalization thing.
Yeah.
And they put that slant on stuff. So, but if you're aware of that, you can sort of unslant it, because the reason I get it is because it has a lot of other really good information aside from their agenda or their narrative. But you just got to be aware of it. Whereas I think there's a lot of people who look at mainstream media and have no idea that there's a narrative going on at all, you know.
Or they're mired in conspiracy thinking and they think it's all lies.
Right, right.
Which is equally unhelpful.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really sort of a transient thing, because you can't really go through life just thinking that all authority is wrong. You know, I mean,
you can, but you're not going to get anywhere.
That's right. Yeah,
so anywhere desirable.
That's right. So,
yeah, I mean, at some point you have to align yourself with larger forces.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can't be in opposition to all structures of power all the time.
Right.
Or, you know, your life is just, it's futile.
Right.
I mean, you've
well, it's interesting that what's happening now, like with Matt Taibbi, and, mm-hmm. you know, he worked with Elon Musk to, you know, they're sort of trolling through all the back, you know, the pre-Musk era of showing how, you know, government agencies and other people were asking Twitter to, you know, don't print this or do that. And unfortunately, it's gotten to be a real mess, because, you know, I've followed Taibbi for years. I followed him when him and Mark Ames were doing the exile in Moscow.
No, when was that?
In the 90s.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And he's always been good, but he's always, you know, he's his own person. And what's happened now, when he linked up with Musk, I guess Musk must have asked him, because he, you know, to be the sort of the outlet for this Twitter stuff. It riled up a lot of people. I have a good friend of mine whose main source of news is like MSNBC and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him about Taibbi, and he went off on a rant. He's like, this guy's awful. He's horrible. Blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'm on it. I get his email feeds, and he's explained what he's been doing. And, you know, in some way, I sort of think, hey, what did he expect Twitter to be doing? Yeah, you know, the fact that the FBI is asking him to follow somebody or whatever, you know, that's not a bad assumption to just assume that that's always happening.
Yeah, but there are differences. Like, Apple famously refused to unlock the iPhone of a woman who had been murdered.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I remember.
You know,
and they found somebody who could unlock it, right?
Yeah, the FBI circumvented Apple security on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Apple, like, if you serve, you don't even have to serve a warrant.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just go to Amazon.com and mm-hmm. say, hey, we're the government and we don't like this person and we want all the information that you have on this person, Amazon's like, sure, here you go, have it.
Yeah.
You know, do you want us to go by his house and beat him up? You
know? Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know. It's,
yeah, so there is definitely a continuum of, you know, cooperation with power.
Mm-hmm.
With or without any sort of moral guidelines or checks on runaway
right.
abuse of power.
Right.
And much as I don't like Apple for a variety of reasons, they score well on that one.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more puzzled. You know, I don't know if you know, I worked at Apple for a few years.
You may have told me that.
Yeah, yeah. This was back in the non-Jobs era. It was like from about 89 to 91.
Okay.
It was an interesting company, but man, it was chaotic, all I can say. anyway, let's getting back to the to this. So we're talking about how ideas get spread around, and again, there's no longer how to put this. You need sort of, I wouldn't call them gatekeepers, but you need somebody to sort of say, "Yeah, this guy's onto something," or "Man, this guy's like a total crackpot," but be able to trust them, because there's a lot of agendas out there where they'll diss somebody. Like, this is what was happening with Taibbi. Mm-hmm. The left now has been really hammering him.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it was you posted the one from The Hill, the video where the woman is talking about the whole Taibbi situation, showing how, you know, the claims against him are baseless, but it's just sort of, you know, just trying to smear him.
Hmm. Do you know who the woman is?
I'd have to go back and look. It's okay. She was a black woman. I remember that. Her hair was up.
Probably Breonna Joy Gray. Then.
Probably. Yeah, I can't remember the name, but yeah.
Attractive?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, yeah. Breonna Joy Gray.
So, anyway, so that's pretty much what I'm going to say about that. You want to get onto the other thing of the, what should be profit and non-profit?
Let's stick here with these corporations, which provide us with these digital tools, which have completely interpenetrated, you know, with our daily experience. Mm-hmm. They have relationships to government power, and they always have, because, you know, Silicon Valley and the electronics industry in general, and particularly, you know, information technology and artificial intelligence and big data manipulation. Mm-hmm. These all started off with military applications and military funding. And, you know, to some extent, some of the countries, companies broke away from, you know, their dependence on defense dollars, and others haven't.
Right.
And then Amazon is, you know, started off completely independent of that and is now trying to get, you know, thoroughly integrated with the intelligence and the military establishments.
Well, that's where a lot of money is.
Yeah, yeah. And money and power and access. Mm-hmm. And Bezos wants all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, he bought this enormous, like, palatial mansion in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. so that he could just have a place like his political base of operations.
Right, pied-à-terre in Washington. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sure he has a gazillion lobbyists working for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have to consider those relationships and those sort of paired sets of interests when evaluating how trustworthy any particular source is on a given topic. And, you know, Google, their avowed mission is to organize the world's information and make it available and useful to people.
Right.
And, you know, clearly they have institutional biases and they have hidden agendas, but, you know, for probably 99.9% of topics, they have no interest, they have no agenda, and they really are just you know, looking to present you with something that is relevant given your search query.
Yeah, although I have to say, it's, I think it's gone downhill recently. Because I still, on devices where I don't go to DuckDuckGo, it's defaulted either to, one of them is Bing, which is the Microsoft one, and the other is Google. And what I find, if I'm having a hard time finding something, I'll try the different ones. And often, Bing is actually pretty good a lot of the time. What's the trouble with Google is, if there's anything commercial related to it, it's going to put the commercial stuff right up top. You know, if it's something that has no commercial interest whatsoever, then you just generally get, you know, what you're looking for.
Exactly. So you need to be mindful of what their interests are and what their agenda is. Mm-hmm. And, determine whether or not that's going to affect the quality of your search results given a particular topic.
Right. And the quality of, I mean, the trust that you put into an organization is important. And I'll give you a good example. It's my own personal experience. Back in the 90s, I was the technical editor for this kind of niche magazine called Vacuum Tube Valley. that me and Charlie Kittleson and Eric Barber put together to sort of cover mainly it's high-end audio with the vacuum tube technology. That was a popular thing, and I was really into that. The trouble with high-end audio, anyone who's sort of worked in that field realizes that there's a lot of crackpots in that field. There's a lot of crazy stuff. And my theory for that is that it's because of the music. Music is an emotional thing. When you're working with the technology that affects the music, the emotions can take over. And this is why you get people who, you know, spend $10,000 on a cable or something. You know, really, that's it's really. And I've designed equipment that went into that market. And I've worked. Wow. I've worked with people. I've gone to the shows, and after a while, I got really skeptical. And what would happen when I was the technical editor? I had a rule. So if someone says, "Hey, you know, this amp sounds really good," and blah blah blah, I would only believe it if either I heard it myself, mm-hmm. or someone who I trusted had heard it and told me themselves. I have some good friends, audiophile friends, who I know not to trust. I mean, they're friends of mine for other reasons, but mm-hmm. I know, you know, this guy's always like falling for the latest you know, thing, and so you know, in the sense, I had to sort of build up my own little trust network. It's a very narrow field, but it's a field that's full of BS. If, you know, I've come to the conclusions that the main high-end audio magazines, are the two main ones, like Stereophile and Absolute Sound, are very corrupt. And I know that I've actually talked to people who've told me about, you know, like if you're not an advertiser in the magazine, they either won't review at all or give you a very sort of, you know, praise, what do you call it? You know, just basically, they're gonna diss you. And so, and unfortunately, the consumer who doesn't know any better is just getting jerked around by this stuff.
Right.
So trustworthiness is important. And the trouble is, in our new world here, how do you know who's trustworthy?
And because we're talking about organizations are controlled by people. There are mm-hmm. power struggles within yep. those organizations. Yep. People retire, people get pushed out, mm-hmm. new people come in. And the, you know, the orientation and agenda of a given institution will change over time. Mm-hmm. So if you get attached to a name or an association that you have with an organization that's more than a few years old, you're kind of, you know, you're navigating via fairy tale.
Yeah, or just past history. Like, I mean, people are, you know, car guys, like there's the Chevy guys and the Ford guys. And, you know, you might always buy Chevys, but then you might realize that, oh, that this thing's a real, you know, POS. You know, unfortunately, GM alienated a lot of their customers, like back in the 70s and 80s by some of the cars they put out.
You know, typically I won't ask these questions. If somebody presents me with an opinion mm-hmm. of theirs, mm-hmm. and I know it's a deeply held opinion that they've held on to for many years. Mm-hmm. Unless I'm feeling particularly rambunctious, I'll just smile and nod and move on.
Right.
But if I want to engage them on the topic, you know, if they present me with some strongly held opinion, I'll ask, well, when did you first form that opinion? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they know, maybe they don't, but they'll maybe introspect a little bit. And then the follow-up question is, when was the last time you revisited that
right,
opinion?
Right, right, right. Because, yeah, sometimes people will just stick something way beyond yeah. reasonable. It's, yeah.
I will withhold a personal example because I badmouthed my father enough in recent days.
Oh, yeah, I know, but it's...
Yeah. So, we're talking about right now institutions mm-hmm. that are private companies mm-hmm. which pioneered the products that they have introduced mm-hmm. and which have become essential elements in most people's daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a very different progression from here's something which is known to be a social good, something mm-hmm. that we need for this society to run. We are going to provision society with this thing, say, mm-hmm. you know, the justice system, mm-hmm. at public expense via public institutions, and then later transitioning to a public-private partnership, and then more and more just offloading those functions onto private corporations, mm-hmm. which have a fiscal agenda.
Right.
So for me, you know, the most glaring example is the prison system mm-hmm. and the Corrections Corporation of America, which is a big lobbying organization, mm-hmm. Which has for decades been, maybe not decades, but for years, mm-hmm. has been pressing both federal and state legislatures to impose harsher sentences and longer sentences mm-hmm. on crimes because it increases their bottom line.
Right, right. Or having contracts that require a certain minimum occupancy of the prison.
Right.
Which skews the whole justice equation.
Yeah, we need bodies in these beds.
Right, right.
So, you know, let's... They never fail to come up with the bodies.
Yep, yep.
Let's just say that.
Right, and it's and given that this is, you know, you're wrecking people's lives if, you know, if you're excessively prosecuting them or, you know, things like that. So, mm-hmm. well, you know, let me start out with the whole, at the beginning of this thing, why did people want to privatize, okay? And I think a lot of the so-called neoliberals or libertarians would privatize because they say, well, look at, you know, government-run institutions are so inefficient. I mean, have you been to the DMV recently? You know, that whole thing. Mm. And yes, that's true. But it doesn't mean that private organizations are the model of efficiency. I think what they're holding up as the good on private organizations are private organizations that are in a competitive environment and there's competition. And if a company starts to go south or starts to get inefficient, the competition will force them either out or to fix the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So what that really gets down to is whether it's a public thing or a private thing, you need ways of fixing bad performance because it's going to happen in either public or private. A good example of things that should be publicly controlled are ones that where there's no real economic motivation for a private company to do it. You know, like, let's say that you wanted to keep a stockpile of food for, you know, in case there was a famine or something like that. What's not, you know, unless the government incentivizes a company to stockpile it for you, the company's not just going to do it by themselves because they, you know, you don't get quarterly earnings from doing that kind of stuff. And, you know, the military is a good example. This is where they want to have control. You know, you wouldn't have a military that's 100% mercenary, would you?
I would not want 100% mercenary military.
Well, and I think there's plenty of examples in history that where that didn't work out very well.
Mm-hmm.
So, on the other hand, the military is always contracting stuff out to private companies. I mean, they've been doing that for, you know, for centuries. But the thing is that they have tight control over it. And, you know, so in a public situation like the army or the justice system or whatever, you know, you can still contract stuff out, but it has to be done in a way where bad performance is easily and quickly rectified.
Right.
And I'll give you a good example of what's not good. In 2008, Mayor Daley, right before the end of his reign of being mayor in Chicago, got this consortium of investors that had been put together by Morgan Stanley to basically buy the entire parking meter system of Chicago.
Wow.
And I can't remember, it was billions of dollars. So it was a big windfall, but the contract was 75 years.
Man.
And it was written to be really hard to break, and they have to always keep the same number of parking meters. So, like, if you want to, like, turn a street, put a bike lane in a street that gets rid of parking, you have to put meters somewhere else to make that number up.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a, you know, a parade or a, you know, close the street for some social thing, you have to pay a penalty because they're not getting money from the parking meters.
It's basically you're subordinating public planning
yeah.
to the profit incentive of a corporation.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, you know, these so-called public-private partnerships, they're almost always initiated by the financial people, the investors, you know, the people who do private equity and things like that. And their motivation is basically to asset strip as much as they can. And there's been plenty of cases. I think there were some private freeways, I think, in Orange County that ended up going bankrupt because they, you know, it was one of these things where, well, we'll have the, you know, the private company will build it and then they'll run it as a toll road. But it turned out that, you know, that they sort of paralleled existing interstates that were free, you know, and you know, they just didn't make enough money. So, you know, so-called PPP, public-private partnerships, they were always being pushed. They have a very poor track record. See, the reason why you can subcontract to private organizations, like in the military and places like that, is because they have tight control. You know, let's say you want to build the atomic bomb, they subcontracted out. You know, Los Alamos and Hanford were, I think Hanford was run by DuPont, but it was they hired DuPont to run it because they had management skills. They did not hire DuPont to say, okay, make this plutonium-239 and put it out on the open market, and whoever wants to buy it can buy it.
And they didn't give DuPont veto power over nuclear arms treaties with the Soviet
exactly,
Union.
Exactly. They were just hiring them to do what they knew how to do, which was to manage a big organization. And that's all they did, you know. And then those kind of things usually work out pretty well. Now, how do you keep public organizations decent, like the DMV, for example? There, what you need, it's the dynamics are different because you don't have a free market, you don't have competition, but you do have people who will notice that there's a problem, and in a lot of cases that'll have to come through the political scheme. You know, you call up your congressman saying, this is blah blah blah, we're having this trouble, and they can apply some pressure somehow. Usually the cases where public systems have gone to hell and haven't been fixed is because there was, due to corruption, for example, there was no effective way to fix it because whoever would fix it was already been paid, you know, bought off. And so you have to make sure you have a way of relatively short term. You can't, no 20-year contracts, have it be,
right,
reevaluated yearly, monthly, whatever would make sense in that situation.
So monthly would be a chore.
But it depends a lot on what it is that you're doing, Anyway, so what's happening is the guys who want to, privatize everything, they'll hold out the competitive market as saying, look how good these companies do, because, but then on the other side of their mouth, they're disabling antitrust regulation, and you end up with monopolies, which then can do whatever they want to do and screw the consumer,
Well, in the private market or the marketplace is efficient, as you say, because there is competition. If somebody is behaving in an inefficient manner, then an upstart can come and, do things more efficiently or just for lower profit margins and push out an established player.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, when a company gets big, they have a strong incentive, and there's plenty of precedent to follow.
Mm-hmm.
They want to capture the regulators of their industry.
Absolutely.
And they want to use that power to prevent competitors from arising.
Mm-hmm.
And typically when, government contracts are being awarded, you can have companies bid.
Yep.
But there are a lot of contracts that are awarded on a no-bid basis because of established relationships and because, the company that is being contracted with is the big player in their industry.
Right, right. And it's the dominant player for, AWS in cloud computing.
Exactly. Which, there goes the efficiency that is guaranteed by, the threat of competition.
Right.
Because the threat of competition is the first thing that, the big players target once they have power.
Yeah, no, actually, AWS does have some competition, but they're still a pretty major player.
Mm-hmm.
But look at, this is where a lot of the new startups are, try to get their investors hooked, because they say, hey, we're going to do something and we're going to be the monopolist. They don't use those words, but we're going to have market power.
Right.
And which means, charge whatever you want.
And a lot of corporations, a lot of startups, their plan and their goal is just to get acquired by a big player.
Yeah. 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 And that's that, there's nothing really wrong with that, but it doesn't, the problem is when, when Facebook starts buying up its competitors and either rolling them into their own product or just shutting them down.
Yeah.
Or look at Adobe. They bought PageMaker. Guess what they did with PageMaker?
Killed it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that was their main competitor back then, in that market back then.
So right now, Meta is the name of the company that owns Facebook, which is, their big products, their big profit centers, the big one is Instagram, which was an acquisition.
Yes.
They didn't create that.
Yep. Yeah. And then, it's, Luckily, the antitrust is getting revisited now. I think it's overdue because we really are seeing a lot of things like the medical field. You know, look at the pharmaceutical companies and things like that. See, they've been working to sort of game the patent system, for example, so they could just make a little tweak on something and, oh, we got another 20-year patent on this. Yeah. You know? And
yeah, our product is going to be generic next year, but what if we make it blue?
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, so it's you know,
what if we tweak the molecule in a way that has no physiological effect?
Right, but it is different.
Is slightly different.
Yes, you know? Yep. So, I don't know. It's actually, you know, I've sort of have this list in my head of what are public facing services that should not be privatized, and healthcare is one.
Mm-hmm.
Justice system is another. Education is another, at least in a lot of cases, is another. And what else? I'm spacing out now. Well, actually, you could talk about things like public utilities. Now, public utilities, and we're talking things like, you know, power, telephone, you know, internet, things like that. You know, when I first moved to California in the 70s, late 70s, I had an apartment in Santa Clara. And then about 2 years later, I bought a house in San Jose, which was right nearby. Well, Santa Clara has its own municipal power company. And I remember at the time that their power rates were almost half of what PG&E was charging. And yet, they're totally reliable. In fact, when they had all those power problems in around the year 2000, when they deregulated and they had to have, you know, rolling blackouts, Santa Clara never had that because their contracts had already been, you know, finalized and everything was cool. And, you know, in a sense, you could argue that yes, it could be private. And if people are ethical and do the right thing, that works. But the problem is that the business culture has really gotten to the point of, you know, greed is good and things like that. It was a good example. There was an article recently, I think it was in the New York Times or Washington Post, about where they compared the healthcare system of the United States to the healthcare system in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that Germany it's very similar. They do not have nationalized healthcare. I mean, they have private insurance companies. They have private hospitals. But people pay almost nothing because the companies will pay insurance. And the hospitals charge. They have strong limits on what hospitals can charge. And there's no out of control, you know, trying to upcharge with the codes and things like that. And it's a completely different thing. In fact, they were interviewing one of the doctors, and at some point they wanted to have every patient pay a certain minimum amount. And the doctors rebelled against that because it's a total pain in the neck to try to get people to pay the, you know, 10 euros or whatever it is. It's easier for me if I just heal them and they go home. You know? So, it seems to be a real sort of degradation of morals and ethics that's driving a lot of the bad behavior now. And I don't know that also. You sent out something on the how this is by the conservative writer, but he was blaming conservative news media for
was this Richard Hanania?
Yeah, for basically sort of trying to get these people to buy, you know, phony stuff and, you know, screw their customers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's, I think, a lack of morals or lack of ethics.
Yeah. Or a different focus. I think conservatives tend to overlook a lot of corrupt business practices, mm-hmm. Because their moral filters are more attuned to identifying parasitic behavior, you know,
right.
Laziness, people not wanting to work, people mm-hmm. wanting to freeload off the public dime or whatnot. And their focus is so taken up, you know, by those concerns that there are whole universes of potential bad behavior that they're just not sensitive to.
Right, right.
And, you know, the left is...
They have their own
focuses
and biases, too. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, but it's actually, I find it kind of odd, you know, particularly with when Trump came into power, how people who I would have thought would have been exemplars of ethics and morality, i.e. Protestant Christians, mm-hmm. just loved the guy.
I remember a quote. It was, you know, a mainstream mm-hmm. reporter. So
yeah.
Democratic, left-leaning reporter covering a Trump rally. And he, you know, he asked a religious man who was at this Trump rally, what he thought of, and he named Trump's various, grabbing by the pussy.
All of that. Yeah. And his business practices or whatever.
And this guy said, he's not a godly man, mm-hmm. but he's God's man.
Yeah, but that's, I have a hard time processing that, you know.
Have you read the Bible?
Well, I haven't read the whole damn thing, but I've read parts.
So all of the most famous characters were real scumbags.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't, you know, paragons of virtuous action, mm-hmm. but they represented the correct team.
Yeah, yeah.
So think about King David.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he saw a woman bathing on her rooftop and said to his advisors, hey, who is that? She married? Hey, send her husband to the front lines and bring her to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a godly man, but God's man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, think of Noah.
You have a much deeper religious background than I do, so you can identify that really well.
Yeah. So, yeah, but, you know, my mother, who is pretty religious and pretty socially conservative, hates Trump, mm-hmm. hates him. Mm-hmm. So she used to listen to a lot of Christian broadcasting mm-hmm. on the radio mm-hmm. and she doesn't listen to it at all anymore because they were pro-Trump.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, that hasn't been without a cost, and I don't think it's sustainable.
Yep.
I think that the rank and file have rebelled and will continue to rebel against, you know, that sort of Republican. But, you know, the Republican Party in general hates Donald Trump.
Yep.
There are political opportunists who see that, for a time anyway, you had to genuflect to the man and endorse his ideas, even though he had no consistent ideas.
Right, really. Right.
And I think that time is largely past.
Yeah, I think so, too. He's, you know, my theory was that I wouldn't see him running in 2024 because he would have probably been indicted and might be in jail, you know. But even without that, I think people are realizing that it's, you know, things are not, you know, it's not as coherent as they would like you to think.
Here's an opinion I've held for 6 years, so maybe it's time to revisit it. But okay. It was my opinion in 2016 that Hillary Clinton was uniquely qualified to lose to Donald Trump. That almost no other candidate could have.
I haven't really thought about that, but I think there's something to that. You know, really, it really is the polar opposites on both of them, who they attract too.
Yeah, she is such a hated figure for most of America, mm-hmm. and the people who like her have an oversized or an outsized opinion of their own influence.
Right.
And combine that, you know, just with her utterly obnoxious statements about, you know, what Andrew Yang would call normal people.
Right.
Combine that with utter incompetence in the campaigning, you mm-hmm. know, in terms of mm-hmm. these key battleground, you know, upper Midwestern states mm-hmm. where they just didn't campaign.
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't campaign at all.
And then guess what?
They lost.
They lost. Yeah. Yeah. No, the Democratic Party really has to sort of wake up, and, you know, the fact that Pelosi is retiring and that, let's say Feinstein is going to, you know, not run again. Mm-hmm. I mean, the trouble is it's been so geriatric. It's like they're still living in the 1980s, you know.
Yeah.
And
kind of burns me up that Pelosi just gets to resign.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well. Yeah. Enough politics.
Yeah.
It's
I think I had one other observation on politics. It can wait. It'll come up.
Okay.
It'll come up again.
Yeah. The getting back to the profit and nonprofit. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is that, you know, look at hospitals. A lot of hospitals that are charging up the wazoo are so-called nonprofits.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is that they're nonprofits, but somehow the money is going somewhere, you know?
Right.
And I remember actually...
It just doesn't go to shareholders.
Right, right. I remember some years ago going with my friend to pick up his sister who's elderly, and at Stanford Medical Center. Now, this is one that was not on the near the Stanford campus. This is up on the peninsula, like in Redwood City or something. And it was a brand new facility. I walk in, huge atrium, grand piano sitting in the atrium, you know, really expensive fittings and, you know, things like that. I'm going, wow, these medical dollars really are being spent in a pretty fancy way here. You know, my view of a hospital is, you know, like linoleum floors and cinder block walls.
Right. <You know? laughs> Last hospital I was in was Dartmouth Hitchcock, and it's very nice.
Yeah.
It's a very nice hospital.
The modern ones, they have a lot of money. I don't know why. But anyway, that's what's a nonprofit and what's not is one thing. Another thing that people seem to overlook is that a lot of for-profit things, I mean, one of the whole reasons for being for-profit is profit. So let's say that you were a municipality and you had a chance to decide what kind of system your power company is going to be. Is it going to be a municipal power company or a commercial one? Well, if it's a commercial one, they have to add their profit margin. It's going to be like minimum 5%, maybe 10%, maybe infinite, who knows, you know? And so for something that's pretty straightforward, you know, and the thing is, there's hundreds and hundreds of municipal power companies around the country. Some of them are large, you know, like LA Power and Water, that's huge. And some like in Santa Clara, that's just this one little city. And there's actually a lot of co-ops up in the rural areas, and they do just fine. And yet the rates are typically lower. And, you know, again, getting back to the ethics thing, Pacific Gas and Electric, you know, the California, Northern California utility.
Yeah, so for non-California listeners, we've already mentioned PG&E.
Yeah.
That's the same. It's Pacific Gas and Electric. And it's also the company that was the villain in the Aaron Brockovich story.
Right.
Most famously.
Right. Now, I've read a book on the history of PG&E, and it's interesting because when power first started coming into California, there were all these, like, little power companies or municipal, like San Francisco had its own municipal power company. And there was all these, like, sort of scattered around. And what happened is that investors put up the money to build up the system. These systems went defunct for one reason or another. PG&E was the company that would come in and scoop it all up, and it would be the vulture to, and then consolidate it all together. And this is like 100 years ago when this happened. But they were generally running things okay. But what happened is that, you know, I think about the time when greed was good, like 1980s or so, you know, they for example, they stopped doing their trimming their around the power lines. And in fact, they were doing stock buybacks. Now, you know that stock buybacks used to be illegal because it was considered to be a stock manipulation technique.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, paying the executives, you know, huge bonuses, doing stock buybacks. Meanwhile, the trees are growing into the power lines, and look what happened. You have these huge fires.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a case, again, where the ethics and morals, you know, failed. So,
But when we talk about ethics and morals failing and then institutions behaving in unethical fashions as a result, it's a little too easy to depict executives as, you know, mustache-twirling villains when, in fact, anybody who lives in an environment of persistently perverse incentives will over time adjust their point of view to be consistent with the environment in which they operate.
Right. And that's, you know... However, I still have problems. Like, well, remember Enron.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to see what they were doing as not really being really criminal on the face of it. And yet they thought that they were doing the right thing.
You know, you can take clearly criminal behavior if it's described in colloquial English and dress it up in legalism and corporate jargon and mathematical models, and suddenly what you would easily recognize in conversational English becomes unrecognizable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're making a lot of money through this process, it would be very difficult to try to get somebody to continue to think, you know, in ethical and moral terms when what they're doing has been abstracted beyond all recognition.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're getting paid a lot of money to do it.
Yeah.
That's, to me, I think that's largely, I don't want to say the problem, because we have so many, you know, our civilization is such a complex entity. It's getting more complex every day. And there is strong financial incentive to make it more complex and opaque and hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of problems, but one of them is the deliberate obfuscation of very simple things like right and wrong.
Right. And that to forward someone's agenda, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, getting back to public utilities, though, the one thing that had been in place that should have kept things under control were things like a public utilities commission.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem in California was that their PUC, public utilities commission, essentially got bought off. You know, they had allowed PG&E to do all sorts of stuff. Like, I don't know if you remember, this is what, 10, 15 years ago, they had a major gas line explode in San Bruno. That's just south of San Francisco.
Yeah.
And again, it was looked like it was like deferred maintenance or something like that. I mean, it killed a bunch of people. It just blew up a whole neighborhood. And the PUC had sort of was like, oh, I don't know. They didn't get on their case, you know. And, you know, they had to pay. There was lawsuits and stuff afterwards, so they had to pay a lot of money. But, you know, that's not a good use of shareholders' value, you know.
Yeah. Well, we are at over an hour, so we should probably wrap it up. But this has been an enjoyable conversation. Before we say goodbye, though, I would invite you to make any closing statement or, you know, final summation or anything that you want to end on.
Well, yeah, we've sort of rambled on about a bunch of different things. And
but we're always following associations from one thing to another. So there is a
connection.
There's a connection and there's a coherent pattern that could probably be extracted from it all.
Right. Yeah, I think the main thing is to not be complacent about where your information is coming from. You know, keep you know, always have a bit of a doubt in your mind, even on places that you think would be totally honest. You have to, you got to do due diligence. And the thing is to be really aware of if someone's trying to manipulate you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have, you know, living in rural Nevada, most of my friends are pretty conservative. And what really bothers me, and I don't really bring this up because I want to stay friends with them, but I guess almost wish I could just shake them and say, do you realize how propagandized you've been by what you just said? You know, and they don't seem to realize that they've been propagandized.
I think it feels good to be effectively propagandized.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, if someone's pushing your pleasure button all the time, that you're gonna like that.
Yeah, and they're also, you know, pumping up your ego by saying you're on the correct side.
Right.
You are essential to, you know, the right functioning and the good outcome for our society. I see that both on right and left in the big media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's all people trying to, you know, manipulate people. And, you know, we talked about this last time is, you know, how to fix the problem. And part of it is to sort of educate people to sense when they're being manipulated. In other words, train their BS detectors to work better.
Yeah.
You know, because that's essential in today's society.
Absolutely. That's probably a good place to leave it.
Yeah, sounds good.
John Atwood, thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been good to talk.
That was John Atwood, and thanks to John, because without him, one, taking the time to drive here from where he lives, which is, I think, like 3 hours away from here, there would be no conversation. I'm just not in a position where I can record, conversations over Zoom or, I used to use Skype. I haven't used Skype in years. These days, StreamYard is what I'm using. But anyway, that requires basically that I have a microphone connected to a computer, connected to an internet connection, and, a quiet place in which to record. And that's typically what is lacking in my life right now. So thanks very much to John for that. Typically, I don't disagree with a guest once they've left, so I'm going to be very careful about how I phrase this. Early on in the conversation, John was talking about how, because communication has become so frictionless, that bad ideas can propagate very quickly. But it seems that good ideas should also be able to propagate very quickly, and they don't. And I don't think it's because of the friction or lack thereof in distributing a message. I think that toxic, harmful messages, which are successful memes because they propagate widely, they appeal to our psychology in ways that good ideas typically don't. And when I say good, I mean, you know, in accord with reality or close to it. So in my own case, you know, my podcast has never been a super commercial success, but compared to, you know, my audience now, the audience that I had 5 or 10 years ago was certainly much bigger, much more engaged, much more enthusiastic, because I was wholeheartedly pandering to, you know, doomer fetishism without fully appreciating what I was doing. Because if I fully appreciated what I was doing, I would not be able in good faith to continue doing it. And so there was no, you know, no bad faith to detect in my effort. But as soon as I became aware of it, I publicly rejected it, you know, rejected the catastrophe fetishism, and most of the audience went away. I think I've gone from providing pretty good content, entertaining content for sure, engaging content and useful content across many, you know, across the spectrum. But in one area, you know, collapse fetishization or, you know, cheerleading for radical discontinuities, not because they're particularly likely, but because such fantasies appeal. You know, they have a deep-seated appeal to people who are very frustrated with their situation and the society in which they live. John ended talking about how we need to increase people's BS detectors. I think mostly, though, I mean, concentrating on BS detection means focusing outward, focusing on other parties. And I think for the most part, most of the benefit we're going to get, even in BS detection, is going to be the result of a more objective focus on our internal states, noticing how we respond emotionally to different messages and making the connections that allow us to recognize when we are being manipulated psychologically. Most importantly, we need to appreciate when that's being when that's happening successfully, not when we are seeing through, you know, the emotional manipulation, the casting of you as an important player on the side of righteousness, you know, in opposition to greed and evil and, you know the litany. I won't list all the names that people who are supposedly bad people get called these days. But I think rather than, I mean, sure, go and study a list of logical fallacies and look for instances of them in the popular media and also in online discourse. That's useful up to a point. But if you're not paying any attention to your own breathing, to your own heart rate, to your own passing fantasies and reveries as you're taking in a message, there are just a lot of connections you're simply not going to be able to make. Now, I'm not calling for intense, ruthless introspection. A gentle, loving, forgiving approach, even when dealing with oneself, I think is going to yield better results in the long term. And that's the beginning of a long, long discussion, which I will not embark upon now. So I'll just leave it there as an indication for future conversations. And those conversations can be with guests like John, or they can be just me talking and you listening and ideas occurring to you, connections, you know, becoming clear to you as you listen, and then possibly you write them down, possibly you post a comment or not. Possibly it just sort of simmers and comes up in a conversation somewhere down the line, you know, that I never hear about. But which will have resulted from me sharing this conversation with John Atwood, at least in part. You know, this ideas that you have while listening to this conversation will, of course, be combined with your point of view, your experiences, and other observations and experiences that you've had. Something that I think is important is to realize and accept, you know, without it being the acceptance of some flaw or some guilt, that we are not superhuman, that we are, in fact, each of us human, and that certain types of persuasion have, over thousands of generations of humans, been refined to be effective you know, to find the weak points in human psychology, in human cognition, and to exploit them, and to circumvent scrutiny, and to, you know, circumvent the perspective that would reveal to us that we're being conned and that we're playing a vital role in our being conned. To understand how our own minds work, you know, even if such a realization entails that we ourselves are not as special and as different from the mass, unwashed, gross, stupid human herd as we would like to believe, it doesn't have to take the form of, oh, I am useless, I am worthless, I am terrible. Just, I am normal. Being normal is not a bad thing. You know, and I know if you're under 30, that's impossible to believe. And that's fine. Most of you aren't under 30. All right. Well, I will not go on and on because there is still much work to do to turn this into a podcast. I guess I will say this. We kind of live in the age of the live stream now, because when the live stream is over, there's a finished product. You don't edit. You don't assemble. You don't have to upload another file. You know, it's just done. You talk into a microphone, and when you're done talking, there's a finished product that people can consume. And podcasting, the old school sort of podcasting that I do here, doesn't work that way. And I've tried to get into the streaming thing, but, you know, I don't know the secret sauce. I don't know the magic to get an audience to tune into that. So in effect, you're getting sort of artisanal podcasting here, which is low volume. And while low volume products are supposed to be superior, I myself consume a lot of mass produced products, which I enjoy quite a bit. Anyway, thank you very much for tuning in to this artisanally produced podcast. There will be more like it. I can't say exactly when, but with greater frequency than you've probably come to expect them. All right. Thank you much. And for those of you who are not watching my YouTube content, you're missing most of what I produce these days because, you know, I can put together a 15-minute video in a couple of hours, whereas a podcast like this takes much, much longer than that. And so it's much easier to put off. All right. Drawing a hard line now. This podcast ends.